From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In one of the best-known episodes of the sitcom All in the Family, Sammy Davis Jr. comes to visit Archie Bunker's house. It's an episode TV director John Rich didn't want to do. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rich about his work on All in the Family, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and other sitcoms. He has a new memoir. Also, we talk with former Olympic athlete and chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency, Dick Pound, about his crusade to free the world of sports from performance-enhancing drugs. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by country singer Bradley Walker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross.
The Dick Van Dyke Show, starring Dick Van Dyke. Rosemary.
If you think there's a golden age of American television, chances are pretty good that my guest John Rich had a hand in some of the shows you love. Rich spent more than 50 years directing, writing, and producing TV shows, including The Dick Van Dyke Show, All in the Family, Gunsmoke, The Twilight Zone, Gilligan's Island, The Brady Bunch, MacGyver, and Murphy Brown. He won 3 Emmys and 3 Golden Globe Awards, and he also directed 5 feature films in the 1960s. Let's get a taste of his work. Here's a scene from The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Where's Rich?
Shouldn't he be eating?
He's already had breakfast.
What do you have?
Waffles and bacon.
How's come he gets all those good things and I always get scrambled eggs?
Well, gee, because when I ask you what you want for breakfast, you always say scrambled eggs.
Well, honey, that's because I'm half asleep. I got scrambled eggs memorized.
John Rich has written a book about his days with great actors and writers, temperamental stars, and cowardly studio executives. It's called Warm Up the Snake, a Hollywood memoir. After coming home from World War II, Rich did a stint in radio and was told that if he wanted to direct television, he'd have to first work as a stage manager. I asked him what he learned from his early days in TV.
Mostly I learned by watching bad directors what not to do. And I don't mean that facetiously. I learned, obviously, from good directors, but you learn more from watching a bad director because you would see how he would get himself into a scrape, and you could say, after a while, you'd begin to figure out, how would I do that a little bit better? And initially, in my mind, I was doing different ways of approaching the sequence, and I'd be wrong, of course, but then some wise head, a producer probably, or writer, would bail the director out, and I would say, aha, so that's what happened. The next time I would sharpen my instincts and I would say, I would do it this way. And I began to hit where I was right.
Can you think of an example of something you learned from bad directing?
Well, there was a director that was scathingly called Captain Video because he used to ask for silly things. For example, they were doing a remote once at the Brooklyn Navy Yard where the battleship New Jersey was tied up. And he said, looking through the camera lens, move the boat 4 feet to the left. Well, the boat was 45,000 tons of warship. It was completely secured by hawsers. And somebody mildly suggested, why don't you move the camera right 4 inches or whatever it was? Oh, yeah, I'll do that. He had unique perspective on what could move and what couldn't move.
Well, you get into the business and of course, catch the wave of early television. And then in the early 60s, you had the great fortune to work on the Dick Van Dyke Show with that cast of
tremendous.
Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore and Rose Marie.
Yep. And Maury Amsterdam.
Right, right. You mentioned in the book that this was such a crackling good cast that you actually had to kind of control the timing of them early on. You found that if you weren't careful, they would kind of peak too early in the week, get too good before they were before the audience.
That absolutely happened on my first try. I had been doing one-camera film shows like Gunsmoke and Bonanza, shows that were out in the field. And there, when you do one camera, you get a 2 or 3 minute sequence, get it up to speed, and immediately put it in the can. You shoot a short section, and that's the way it was done. It was very efficacious to do that. I came on to the Van Dyke Company. It was a 3-camera film. And the company was so good that on my very first day, I found that I was employing the same method. I was getting them up. And they were just terrific. And by the end of the day, we had staged the entire piece. And the cast was euphoric. Everybody was saying, what a wonderful day. And it was. Driving home, I thought, it was a great day. And then suddenly it hit me. Oh, my God. I have just done what the coach of the professional team has done. I got the people up on Thursday for a show for a football game that doesn't play until Sunday. I've got this cast up on Wednesday, and we don't go on the air until Tuesday. It's going to be stale. And I said, oh, my goodness, it was stupid of me to do that. When I came in the next day, they were all raring to go. They said, the best day of rehearsal I'd ever had. I said, yeah, it was very good, but I have a couple of ideas. I called the prop department, the prop man over, and I said, please, rearrange. I told him quietly, I said, rearrange the set so that it's completely backwards, in a sense. And I took a break. We rearranged the set. I asked the actors to go through the motions, and they kept stumbling into things, and they say, what was wrong with yesterday? I said, well, it was good, but there may be something we can find better here. I forced them to fool around for an entire day, wrecked the day, actually. They were irate. Well, I shouldn't say irate, but they were puzzled mostly, but a little annoyed. And on the third day, on Friday, when I came in, I said, you know, you were all right. Let's put the set back the way it was on Wednesday. And then they performed beautifully. From then on, I said, I will never, ever get a company up that fast. You've got to do it incrementally, a little bit at a time, before you don't want it to peak too soon.
Well, let's talk about All in the Family, which was such a hit and something that a real breakthrough series on television. And it was interesting how this came to you. You had two great opportunities at once, and this looked like the weaker of the two, right, in some ways.
Oh, not just the weaker. It looked like, no, it was the stronger of the two, but in my view, it was the one least likely to succeed because of its language. The shows that you're referring to, on the same day, this is incredible, for a freelance director, I was offered the pilot for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Norman Lear had called with the pilot of All in the Family. I read both scripts. Mary's script was outstanding. It was funny and wonderful, but in the genre of really excellent situation comedy. But All in the Family had this language that I said, this is 1970. Nobody will allow this on American television. And it was so compelling to me because the writing was terrific. I called Mary and I said, look, I'm going to have to pass on your show, but I know it's going to be a big hit. But I've got to try this other thing as an experiment. Now, I don't think it's going to get on the air, mind you. And I think it'll be dead after the first couple of episodes, but I've got to try it. So if you will have me when this thing fails, I'll be delighted to come back and do some of the episodes of Mary Tyler Moore, gladly. But I have to pass right now. Well, I took the job on All the Family. It was a great risk because I thought this will never get on the air.
Well, it was so different. And one of the moments that I love in the book is where I guess you'd done the first 13 episodes, and it wasn't clear if the network was going to renew it, and then...
No, it was very clear. We were canceled.
The answer was no.
The answer was we're finished.
And then you're in Hawaii, and you meet this person. Tell that story.
Well, because we were canceled, then I was rather tired. I mean, after 13 weeks of live work, no editing, I took my family to the island of Kauai, and we were having lunch, and the waitress was a very nice Japanese lady, who was very apologetic. She said, do you mind if paying for the lunch right now? It was 2 o'clock and I have to leave early. I said, sure, but may I ask, what's so compelling on a Sunday afternoon that you want to get home? She said, it's television. There's a new show called All in the Family, and I've got to watch this. Well, I was amazed, but I didn't tell her my connection, but I said, what is it about the show that appeals to you so? And she said, that Archie Bunker, that's my husband. Well, I thought, holy mackerel, if a Japanese lady can make this adjustment, I'll bet you this is happening in other places because people are going to be... I had heard already from some people who had said, you know, that's my father. And in fact, it was Norman Lear's father and a good piece of my father, I hate to say, and people who are trapped by old-fashioned notions. So sure enough, when I got back, apparently they had put the show on in reruns in the summer, and it began to catch on.
Well, one of the more memorable episodes was where Sammy Davis Jr. ends up coming to visit Archie Bunker, who happens to be a black guy that Archie Bunker really likes.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
now,
yeah.
But you know, this is a film of working class people in Queens. Why did you decide to get Sammy Davis into a show?
Well, we didn't want to do it, frankly. Norman came to me one day and he said, Sammy Davis' agent... had said, when is Sammy going to be on? I said, what are you talking about? Well, apparently, in our opening weeks, Sammy had been on the Johnny Carson show and was talking about this new show, All in the Family, and praising it. And we thought, this is wonderful. We need the publicity. It's great. And so the agent called Norman and said, when is he going to be on the show? And Norman said, well, I don't think he's going to be. He came to me, said, what do you think about Sammy Davis on the... I said, no, just exactly what you just said. It's a middle-class Queens family. What? How do you put these two together? If anything, it would be not typecasting, but it would be celebrity casting, which we don't want to do because you can't have that kind of visitation. And the agent said, well, he can play any part. And we said, no. If he ever showed up, he'd have to be himself. He's too big a star. And he kept going and going. And Sammy kept talking about, I'm going to be on the show. And one day, Norman came and said, you know, the pressure is on. Maybe we can do one episode. I said, well, you're going to have to lay down an awful lot of pipe, which a phrase we use for exposition, to explain how it's even possible. So cleverly, Norman began
meaning
to
set up a plot so that he gets there
set
and it's
up
believable.
Plot line, but it had to have been done carefully some 6 or 7 weeks earlier. So Norman came up with the idea of having Bucker occasionally drive, moonlighting a cab, Munson's cab. He would drive this taxi, which would allow Sammy Davis to get into the cab one night, leave a briefcase, and with that conceit, we would say, Archie would find the briefcase, and because he had given Sammy his address and his phone number, because he wanted a picture, and the briefcase was left in the cab, and Archie had it. The phone rings, and it's Sammy saying, you've got my briefcase. And Bunker says, oh, yeah, it's over at the cab office, but I can get it for you. He said, well, if you can. He said, I'm on my way to the airport, and I can stop up at your house.
And I guess the big payoff moment of the show is when Sammy Davis meets Archie and says goodbye, right?
Right. They had talked for a while. It was beautifully done. Sammy was great. But at the first reading, everything went very well. The script sounded terrific, and we were all very happy. But as the script ended and the cast was dismissed for coffee, for take a break, I kept sitting there thinking there's something wrong. And Lear came over and said, what's going on? I said, well, I think we have a good show. The script is good, but there's no finish. The finish that was written was that a neighbor wants to take a picture of Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy says, and Archie said, no pictures. And Sammy says, no, I want a picture with my friend Archie, whatever it was. And by all means, take the picture. I want to remember this occasion. And then he leaves. And I said to Norman, it's flat. I'd like to have something real physical that goes on. And I don't know what, and as I sat there, I started to grin. And Norman said, you got something? I said, maybe. I said, I think Sammy ought to kiss Archie on the cheek. And Norman said, you think, really? I said, yeah, it's worth a shot. I said, I think it's a wonderful finish. I think it'll work. Well, it worked, if I may say, brilliantly. In fact, the applause and the laughter was so long that we had to cut it down because you couldn't stay on it that long. The audience just went berserk.
We're speaking with John Rich. He's a veteran TV and movie director, and he has a new memoir called Warm Up the Snake. Let's hear some of Sammy Davis Jr.'s visit to the Bunker House.
You know, Sammy, them words I just heard you saying here, they reminded me of something that I always wanted to ask you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, now, you're being colored. Well, I know you had no choice in that. But whatever made you turn Jew?
I'm sorry, Mr. Davis. Sometimes my father says wrong things.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
But he's not a bad guy, Mr. Davis. I mean, like, he'd never burn a cross on your lawn.
No, but if he saw one burning, he's liable to toast a marshmallow on it.
More with John Rich after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining me, my guest is John Rich. His new memoir is Warm Up the Snake. One other question I had to ask you about All in the Family. You know, one of the sets that was used a lot was the dinner table, the four of them sitting around the dinner table.
Right.
And you see this a lot in movies and television where people are supposed to be eating, but they're not really eating. They don't really take bites. They push food around. You insisted that people ram food into their mouths. Why?
Well, because one of my deep complaints is exactly what you just said. I hate to see an eating scene where people sit down to a meal and they don't eat. They just push the peas around, and of course there's a real reason for it, and it's because an actor doesn't want to get stuck with food in his or her mouth to deliver their lines. But I said, look, on the Bunker family, I said, when dinner is served, you folks should be ravenous, and we should really play it with real food. Eating carefully has to be choreographed. It is not a simple thing to do. You have to be able to figure out how much you can take, how much you can masticate, how much you can put on the side of your mouth to be able to deliver the lines. So I said, let's rehearse with food. So we got stew. The prop man brought in, I think it was some canned stew, and Carol O'Connor said, I can't eat this stuff. I said, well, he said, you're right about the eating, but I can't eat this. I said, okay. I said, let's send out to Chasen's. It was a very famous restaurant in Hollywood. They made a stew that was made of Kobe beef, I think. It was very expensive, but it was terrific. And the family would sit down, and we would eat all this food. And I said, it has to be ravenous. You must, everybody fight for your, and eat a lot, which they did. Now, that's what gave it...
Why did you want them? Why did you want that? Wouldn't it have been just as effective to deliver the lines? No?
No, no, no. It's very funny because you got extra moments out of it that were terrific. Glaring, you know, somebody going for the same piece of meat, somebody going for the same roll or whatever, or Archie deliberately putting too much ketchup on something, but Edith looks at him reproachfully, and Archie puts more ketchup on. All has to be timed. Yeah, there was a moment I had between Carol and Meathead where they meet over a piece of something and glare at each other. But, there's an air of verisimilitude. Is that the word?
Right, like a real family, right.
It was a real family, yeah.
John Rich, you opened this book with describing a meeting with some young TV people where you're pitching yourself for a job, and they love you because you've done all this amazing stuff, and they kind of say, well, this is like talking to a legend, and then you realize that once you're a legend, maybe it's time to stop doing it and start writing it. I wanted you to reflect a little bit on how the business has changed. I mean, you write about this some in the book. Do you think you could direct television nowadays?
No. I could direct it if they left me alone, but they don't let you alone. I don't care who you are. You now have the assistance of a phalanx of writers. You have the assistance of a network. You have the assistance of a studio. You have people who are sponsors for the product. They all come down, and they all have an idea of what to do. And it's direction by committee. And, of course, it's like the old saw that a camel is a horse that has been designed by a committee.
Right, right.
And also, I believe in the privacy of the rehearsal. It's essential to me to let the actors be able to be foolish if they want to be in rehearsal, to find something deeper than the words themselves. You can't do that when there are people who are watching. You have to have an in-group. So I forbade anybody, to visit during the 3 days of private rehearsal. In that way, the actors could really find something to play. They could do physical things that they would never try in front of somebody else. The minute somebody walks into that room who is not of the in-group, they begin to perform. And the last thing I want on a rehearsal day is performance. I want investigation. Huh. And that's what they were able to do.
There was a moment you describe in the book where the child and some friends of studio executives came in. And very important people, you didn't care, you chased them out.
It was not studio executives, it was the network that I was on. It was ABC. one day I had my rule. I was working privately with my group. And I noticed a cadre of people suddenly standing at one end of the stage, of the studio. So I immediately called a break. I didn't want anything to be seen. And I looked at my assistant, Doug Smart, and I said, Doug, and I just nodded. He said, yeah, I know. And he went over to talk to these people to leave. And he came back, and they were still there. I said, what's going on? He said, it's Buffy Thermopolis. I said, oh, that's a great name. But what's Buffy Thermopolis? I said, I recognize the last name. I said, it could be Tony Thermopolis' daughter, who happened to be president of ABC. And he said, yeah, that's who it is, and she wants to watch you work. And I said, no, be very polite and tell her that this is a closed set today. She's welcome to come on any Monday or Tuesday, because then we have cameras and the actors are no longer investigating. They're really playing now, and it's almost a finished product. So be nice. So he went over and they left. And he came back and he said, boy, she was steaming. You're going to hear about this. I said, look, you know how we work. All right, half hour went by. The phone page on the set came over and said, Mr. Rich, there's a phone call for you from New York. Tony Thermopoulos is calling. My president. I said, okay, I'll take the call. Now, I was conscious that everybody would hear my end of the conversation. So I launched into a rapid-fire delivery. I said, Tony, I'm so glad you called because I was going to call you. I don't know if you remember my two boys, Anthony and Robert. Anthony is now 12, Robert is 10, and we're going to be in New York in a couple of weeks, and they have both expressed great interest in seeing how a network executive conducts his business. They're very well-behaved boys, so do you mind if I bring them into your office? They'll stand quietly in a corner and watch you negotiate contracts. Will that be all right with you, Tony? Okay? What do you think? There was a long silence. I said, by the way, why'd you call me? He said, oh, just seeing how things are going. I said, thanks for the call. Bye.
Oh. Well, John Rich, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, I thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
John Rich spent more than 50 years in television. His new book is Warm Up the Snake, a Hollywood memoir. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew when you were there.
Dance for girls and men, women. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare state.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dick Pound has nothing but contempt for cheaters in sports, and he's on a mission to catch them. Pound is a former athlete, chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency, and a member of the International Olympic Committee. Coming up, we talk with him about his crusade against performance-enhancing drugs. And Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by country singer Bradley Walker. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. If there's a true zealot in the battle against steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs in sports, it's our guest, Dick Pound. He calls athletes who stoke their performances with drugs the sociopaths of sport, cheaters who respect neither their fellow competitors nor the games they're playing. Pound was an Olympic swimmer for Canada in the early 60s and has been a member of the International Olympic Committee for 25 years. In 1999, he founded the World Anti-Doping Agency, which has worked to develop a single list of banned substances, as well as testing protocols and uniform punishments for those caught doping. The agency has had considerable success in amateur athletics, but Pound has harshly criticized pro sports for moving slowly on the issue. Pound's blunt comments about drugs in sport have embroiled him in several public controversies, most famously with champion cyclist Lance Armstrong. Dick Pound's new book is called Inside Dope: How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them. Well, Dick Pound, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you were an Olympic swimmer, competed in the 1960 Olympics in Rome. Do you think the athletes around you then were doping?
Certainly not in swimming. I think there was some indication that, you know, the weightlifters had already got into the steroids, and I think the field folks, you know, the shot putters and discus throwers in track and field. But beyond that, certainly not to my knowledge. It hadn't spread generally to other sports.
Well, Dick Pound, it's interesting, I think, for a lot of people to observe that your organization, the World Anti-Doping Agency, is a relatively young thing. I mean, this really came out of scandals in the late 90s. What prompted the formation of the World Anti-Doping Agency?
Well, I think the real key event was the 1998 scandal in the Tour de France when Festina team was caught with industrial quantities of doping substances and equipment and so forth, and were arrested by the French police. That was kind of a wake-up call for the European-based international sports federations, who said, gee, if this can happen to cycling, which is a very popular sport, in its blue ribbon event, the Tour de France, this could happen to my sport. And I don't want to see that happen to my sport. So that was one element of it. The other element of it was that, unfortunately, the then president of the International Olympic Committee, also watching all of this stuff on television, says, for me, this is not doping. You know, unless you can prove that whatever it is actively damaging to health, I don't think it should be called doping, and I think the IOC list is too long, and on he went. Having forgotten that he'd invited a Spanish journalist to be with him for the day, you know, to see how Juan Antonio runs world sport, that sort of thing. And this guy could hardly believe his ears because everything was on the record. He's writing it all down as Samaranch is saying this, and the next day out it comes in the Spanish media. And that produced an absolute firestorm of public attention and criticism about the IOC and the result was, we said, look, you know, nobody trusts the individual sports to go after their riders or players. Nobody trusts particular countries to be hard on their own athletes if they catch them doping, and nobody trusts the IOC anymore. So what we need is an independent agency that's not controlled by any of these stakeholders to kind of take charge of this on a world level, and also to recognize that while sport can do a lot of things, you know, we know who the athletes are, we know where they are, we know pretty well what they're doing, we know who their coaches are, we know who the bad coaches are, you know, that sort of thing. But there are a lot of things we can't do. I mean, we can't prevent trafficking in drugs. We can't enter into premises and seize evidence. We can't compel the giving of evidence under oath, and a whole bunch of things that only governments can do. So the solution has to be a combination of sport plus the public authorities.
You know, one of the stories that you tell in the book is that of the sprinter Kelly White. You mm-hmm. go into that in some detail. Remind our audience of her experience with doping and the lessons you think it bears.
Well, Kelly White was one of the American sprinters who was caught up in the famous Balco affair. Her initial brush with doping came out of the World Championships in 2003 in Paris, when she tested positive for a stimulant, quite a strong stimulant called modafinil. And the explanation that was concocted for this was, first of all, that it wasn't a stimulant, which is wrong, it is a stimulant, and secondly, that she was taking it for a condition called narcolepsy, which meant that she could fall asleep without warning and in, you know, circumstances that might be dangerous. You don't want to have somebody with narcolepsy driving a car because they could fall asleep at the wheel. It turned out on examination that of course, she did not have narcolepsy. There was a doctor produced by the Balco people who said that he had met with her four times as a patient and he had prescribed modafinil as required, like she had a few little pills of this stuff available for this so-called condition of narcolepsy. Kelly White said she'd never even heard the word until it had been mounted in her defense. And it was so obviously a preposterous position. I mean, was she going to fall asleep sometime between the start of the 100 meters and the finish, you know, over the course of an 11-second race? I mean, it didn't make any sense. So she got disciplined for that. And then, of course, her name turned out as part of the big THG scandal. And this was one of the designer steroids that was discovered. And she was one of the users, and when confronted with this, she agreed to accept a suspension for having used that. But she came and spoke to the World Anti-Doping Agency Foundation Board a couple of years ago just to describe how this happened, how her coach basically pushed her into doing this and introduced her to the guy that ran Balco.
Balco being the Bay Area lab that was the source of doping right. for a lot of athletes. Yeah.
And she was introduced to Victor Conte, who supplied this stuff to her. But the scary part of it was this was stuff that was going straight from a laboratory into the system of athletes with nobody having done any testing to see what the side effects would be. And she had, I mean, aside from the acne and all of that sort of stuff that you get from steroids, she was having, two menstrual cycles every month, and she had blood pressure that was going through the roof. And these folks had no idea. They'd say, oh, well, maybe you should take a little less or, drink some more water, stuff like that. It's probably a miracle that some of those athletes didn't die from what they were being given.
You know, you mentioned that she had explained the presence of this stimulant, or people had explained on her behalf that it was for this condition, narcolepsy, this, spontaneous falling asleep, and that she said she not only did she not have it, she'd never heard of it. Did the doctor who offered that explanation suffer any repercussions from this phony defense?
Not to my knowledge. No, that's part of the difficulty in the whole doping issue is that, to date, 99.9% of the people who bear the brunt of sanctions are the athletes, and the enablers get away.
One of the things you write about are some of the creative techniques that athletes employ to hide doping. What are some of the more innovative things we've seen?
Well, there are masking agents, of course. There are making yourself unavailable for out-of-competition testing. There are, you use the substances and the methods prior to competition, and you do it, far enough in advance that the stuff has cleared your system, even though you still have the benefit of it, like as would be the case for human growth hormone or steroids. And there's, and for some urine tests, there are manipulations. You try and make it, provide different urine from your own. You try and make sure that the samples get degraded in some way, so that you're not going to get a positive test. There, lots of innovative things that can happen.
Do athletes actually inject clean urine into their bladders?
It has been done, yes. And the other thing they do is they have a different, like a balloon or a bladder that they insert, depending on whether you're male or female, into their anus or their vagina, with a little tube, and they provide the urine from that rather than their own urine. So some of it's fairly disgusting.
Yeah, and then just to extend the bad taste one more step, what's a whizinator?
A whizinator is a false penis to which is attached a sort of a catheter and another source of urine. That's one of the things that the NFL football player Ontario Smith was caught with. And it's clearly to avoid detection of doping substances in a urine test.
My guest is Dick Pound. His new book is called Inside Dope. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Dick Pound. He is chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency and author of a new book called Inside Dope, How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them. You know, one of the issues that's raised in this issue in professional sports and amateur sports is what is a fair penalty for a positive doping test? I mean, I think Major League Baseball now has finally come to a 50-game suspension, I believe, which is about a third of a major league season. What is fair, do you think, for someone who is clearly caught using performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, the consensus that we worked out when we put together the World Anti-Doping Code, which is kind of a, you know, we had sports that had gave a lifetime ban for the first offense, and we had some that sort of gave a two-week ban that you could serve between Christmas and New Year's. You know, I mean, a lot of different things. We settled on 2 years as being the normative penalty for the first serious offense of doping. And, you know, sometimes there are explanations and so on that might lead to a reduction of that, and in some cases even an elimination. But the professional sport teams just aren't interested in that. I mean, I think we could probably get them along to, you know, agreeing that the list should be the same and that the testing should be more rigorous and that there should be an independent results management service and so on, so that positive cases aren't getting hidden. But the thought of losing some star for 2 years over a little thing like drug use, in their view, is just out of the question. You know, the third of the season, a little less than a third of the season penalty in baseball is a big improvement over their first really tough, as they call it, program, where the first time you got caught, you got counseling. I mean, I don't know what they would counsel you about being stupid or how to get around it the next time. You know, the second time you tested positive, you might get a fine of up to $10,000, which is walking around money for some of these guys. You know, this is the third time now you've been caught, you might get up to a 10-game suspension. And it really wasn't until you held up the same liquor store five times that you might face a suspension of up to a year. So that was clearly ludicrous.
You know, Dick Pound, you and I have never spoken, but I have to. I note that you you speak in measured terms and clearly think carefully about what you say, and yet your media image is a bit of a bomb thrower on this issue. I mean, you've created a lot of controversy. And I read in a piece earlier this year in the New York Times where you said that your job is in part to make it visceral. And another quote, maybe from the same piece, you said, in a sense, I'm happy to be known by the folks that hate me. Is it your personality to be controversial, or your mission?
It's really part of the job description. I mean, what you're dealing with are pretty clear rules that everybody and rules that for the most part have been adopted with the interest of sport and the health of athletes. You know, that's what the rules are, and you've got people who are cheating, and so that has to be confronted. I mean, you have to shine a bright light on it. You have to, you know, lift up the carpet and see what's under there. And there are a lot of people that are not much interested in having that light shone or the carpet lifted. So it is confrontational. And the people who scream are not the athletes who are playing fair. And the visceral stuff is a way of trying to get the public at large to understand that this is a real problem. You know, and you do that by saying, you know, do you want your child to have to become a chemical stockpile in order to be successful at sport simply because there are a whole bunch of sociopaths out there that are prepared to ignore the rules. And people say, well, no, that's not what I want.
You know, I guess some of the controversial moments that have arisen involve cases where there are athletes who, against whom there is some evidence of doping, but the case maybe isn't so clear. Marion Jones, the international track star in 2004, was, you know, the recipient. Well, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence involving her husband and, I guess, a boyfriend, and then eventually some grand jury testimony in the Bay Area lab case, but not a positive test. And some would say that in a situation like that, given the authority of your position as chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency, you should be careful about commenting until it's clear that you have a violation here.
Well, I'm very careful about what I say. I mean, I have to respond to questions. I mean, somebody in your business calls me up and says, you know, what's the story on Marion Jones? I can't say, gee, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have to say what's out there. Circumstantial evidence is nevertheless evidence. And what I've always been very careful to say is that she has not been charged with an anti-doping violation. There is a lot of it. You mentioned something. I mean, there was a show on 2020 on ABC a year or so ago where Victor Conte said on national television, I sat beside her, I dialed up a shot of human growth hormone, I gave it to her, I watched her roll up her shorts and inject it into her thigh. You know, that's evidence of a sort. It's still, nobody has charged her with a doping violation, and she's entitled, and I've made that very clear, to the presumption that she has not doped until that happens. She had a case this summer where she had a positive A test for EPO, which was not confirmed by...
Just explain for our audience what A test and EPO, what you mean. Yeah.
This EPO is short for erythropoietin, and it's a substance that is taken that stimulates the production of red blood cells in the blood, which means you can carry more oxygen to muscles and therefore improve your performance. When a test is done, the sample is divided into two roughly equal parts, which are called the A sample and the B sample. And if an A sample produces a positive result, which is what happened in the case of Marion Jones for EPO, she is entitled, as is everyone, every other athlete, to request that the B sample be analyzed and to have a representative present at that time. That was done, and the B sample did not confirm the A. We're not sure why yet. We're trying to figure out why that is. But the result is that there is no doping. The failure to confirm with the B sample cancels out the A sample, so she has not officially tested positive. All I've ever said, and this goes back to 2004, is that I hope the people that are looking after her interests have her best interests at heart.
Right, but and I have to say, when I read the comments that you made about her, there was no case in which you convicted her before evidence was clear. I think it was the kind of comment where if this evidence is such, then serious consequences should result, like the removal of medals. One of the questions hers and others raise is, what's the standard of proof that should bear upon an athlete who violates a drug use policy? I think a lot of their lawyers would say essentially they should be the same standards that one would use in a criminal trial.
Yeah.
What's your view?
My view is that this is not a criminal matter. This is a sport. These are all sport rules, and the standard of proof that has evolved in the sport jurisprudence is what's called a comfortable satisfaction with the evidence. So it's less than proof beyond all reasonable doubt and higher than a mere balance of probabilities.
Well, Dick Pound, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, it's fun. Thank you.
Dick Pound chairs the World Anti-Doping Agency. His new book is called Inside Dope: How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the striking debut album of country singer Bradley Walker. This is Fresh Air. Country singer Bradley Walker is 27 years old, but his vocal style harkens back to an earlier generation of vocalists, such as George Jones and bluegrass pioneer Bill Monroe. The Athens, Alabama native was born with non-degenerative muscular dystrophy that's kept him in a wheelchair all his life. As an adult, Walker has maintained a full-time job as a systems analyst at the Browns Ferry Nuclear Power Plant while performing in local clubs on weekends. Walker's first album is called Highway of Dreams, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's one of the most striking debuts of the year.
I like a happy song in a loud and smoky place. Sweet home Alabama puts a smile on my face. But if you want my opinion, I can tell you for certain that I sing a whole lot better when I'm hurting. Some nights when I...
Bradley Walker possesses a remarkably flexible voice that belies his youth. He usually starts out in warm middle range and then shifts up into a high plaintive register to inflect romantic agony, a strategy one of his heroes, George Jones, perfected. But Walker also uses a conversational tone on many of the songs on Highway of Dreams, content to put a lilt on the end of syllables and let the rhymes of the verses carry the musicality, much as Willie Nelson does. The fact that I can even dissect Walker's vocal strategies so precisely attests not only to what a pro he is for a guy who's not yet 30, but to how such good music invites curiosity about how he pulls it off.
Here stands an open bottle. Here stands an empty glass. My new best friends console me and forgive me for my past. We all join here together to pay our last respects to a love I couldn't keep alive and now I can't forget. Born in 1999 inside her heart and mine.
On Highway of Dreams, Bradley Walker works with a backup band that emphasizes fiddle and dobro and the harmonies of guest stars such as Rhonda Vincent and Vince Gill. His producer is Carl Jackson, who's worked as a guitarist with everyone from Garth Brooks to Emmylou Harris. Because the album Walker and Jackson have conceived is such a throwback to old commercial country music, even down to its number of songs, a succinct dozen, none much over more than 3 minutes, he naturally didn't get signed to a big commercial label. And so he's on Rounder Records, home of bluegrass stars like Alison Krauss, and marketed as such. But while Bradley Walker has a lot of bluegrass in his wail, he is, at heart, a hardcore honky-tonk man, as his trenchant cover of Lefty Frizzell's I Never Go Around Mirrors proves decisively.
Well, I can't stand to see a good man. One who never combs his hair or shaves his face. A man who leans on wine over love that's told a lie. Oh, it tears me up to see a grown man cry. See me without you by my side. No,
I haven't referred to Bradley Walker's muscular dystrophy because it doesn't influence his music in any way that I can hear. But I listened to his album before I'd seen or read about him. And while he has a definite attraction to liquor-soaked melancholy and plaintive loneliness, well, so does every first-rate country singer. I hope what amounts for such a fine performer to just a good publicity angle doesn't limit his appeal as a star personality. Because this young man doesn't need our curiosity or our sympathy. What he needs is enough of our appreciation to be able to quit that nuclear power plant job, to pursue this phenomenal country bluegrass thing he has going for himself full time.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the debut album from Bradley Walker. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Well, I try to stay on the straight and narrow, but I walk the crooked path. I felt worthy of forgiveness and deserving heaven's wrath. Right on the money and off by mile, ahead of my time and way out of style.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston by James Hornfisher, author of The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. From TIAA Craft, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for the New York Times, who's just returned from Iraq. We'll talk with him about the efforts to stem violence in Baghdad and the prospects for change in American policy. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.